Hello. This is Jack. He belongs to my neighbour. He's a good boy. Hello.
So, walking down Serdar Road, which is, you know, my neighbourhood, I can see the burnt-out shell of Grenfell Tower. Grenfell Tower has been a prominent feature of my life since I was a kid. Everywhere you go in this really amazing neighbourhood, you can see Grenfell Tower. I'm used to seeing that full of life, but now it's just a dead carcass.
And there it is, right there, the dead black block. We see it each morning, filled with debris and dust, when so much was driven out by the fire and carried away by the wind. It's all around us, in the air we breathe, in our tormented nights, in our dreams. And the giant ruptured incinerator is there to greet us, as always, when we awake.
We're standing on a platform at Latimer Road tube station, and it's looming over everything. It's so close. You can see two people, forensic experts, working in one of the rooms. For me, what Grenfell Tower is now is an invasion of my privacy. I'm forced to look at this building daily, and that's not doing me or anybody that lives in this area any good. I'm sitting on a park bench with a friend of mine who's a local resident. How do you feel when you look at the tower every day, and how does it make your children feel?
Every single time we see it, it traumatises us because, in effect, it's a graveyard. Our neighbours, friends, teachers, they are there, you know. When we leave school, I try to find a way to get to the bus stop, for example, where my children won't have to see Grenfell Tower, which isn't very easy because it's visible from many viewpoints, from the playground and also from one of the exit points of the school. Grenfell Tower is very prominently visible, so there's no avoiding it. We watched people shout for help, scream for help, and like many other people, we just watched people. One minute, there was like a very vivid...
Okay.
A very vivid image that we'll never leave is there were two or three children in the window, and then you could see the fire behind them. We kept saying, there's children, you know, and then all of a sudden they were no longer there anymore. And another image was the lady waving the piece of cloth, and at that point in time we didn't realize it was our teacher. Then when we, you know, read in the news, we had actually watched her. One of her children was very young. She had three children, and you have an elderly person. Who was she supposed to try and save first? You try not to think of that because it's just unimaginable. You can't. It just hurts too much to think about that. But this is the reality of what happened. It hasn't got any better. If anything, it gets worse. The children can ask a question that just catch you. They'll say that they're scared the tower's going to fall on them. They're scared that they're going to die. They're scared that people are going to die. And what can you explain to children? You know, do you say it's an accident when you don't feel in your heart there is an accident because it was avoidable?
What do you think needs to happen? Some people are saying they want it covered up because children are, you know, shouldn't have to see that every day. And others are saying that it should stay like that to stand as a testament for what happened. How do you feel about that?
I think until it's ready to come down, it should not be covered up in any shape or form. People that aren't from the area need to see the horror, the immensity of what's happened. It needs to be uncovered. It shouldn't be another cover-up.
The crowd that night from the neighbouring blocks, the finger blocks, forced to watch, lights at the windows, torches of those who were still alive, for the time being, signalling desperate, faint hope, until floor by floor, the darkness snuffed them out. I'm Alan Everett, and I'm the vicar of the parish of St Clement and St James. St Clement's Church is very close to Grenfell Tower. I began writing the poem at the beginning of August. In its own way, that was very cathartic. I would say that the tower inflicts a form of visual abuse on people on a daily basis. The memories of what they saw and they heard get rekindled every time they look at the tower. And I think it's one of the things which is going to face this community, what to do with the tower. Some people really do feel that the tower should remain as it is, as a perpetual indictment of incompetence and neglect. Whereas others, of course, want the tower to come down as soon as possible, can hardly bear to look at it.
As you go up the building, the cladding starts to melt away and then it gets to the black where it's all been burnt away. After that, nothing. Empty windows, charred concrete. On the side of the buildings, I can see the connectors that house the cladding. It almost looks like bones sticking out of a dead building.
I'm Michael Lockwood. I was brought in as part of the Grenfell response team in charge of Grenfell Tower, and at the same time also still Chief Executive of London Borough of Harrow, which is tough to do both.
So we're now 6 months in, Michael. Can you give me a progress report of where we are?
Yes, so obviously that building's a dangerous structure, and our priority is to make sure it was safe and stable. And the phase we're at now is we're putting up the scaffolding, and we have to make sure the foundations can support it, because the building can't.
So I noticed that you've started covering the building
from
the bottom up. I think you're up to the fourth or fifth floor, is that correct?
We're at seventh.
Okay.
So it should be coming increasingly visible by Christmas, yeah? And then another, we think, 12 weeks maximum to cover the whole building. But the covering was a very big issue. It's people's homes, remember? And a very emotional decision, understandably. So what we've tried to do is speak to the bereaved, survivors, and the community around the tower.
Yeah.
And obviously, we gave a particular weighting to the bereaved. But it was very interesting as to what those conversations revealed. There was a very, very significant minority on all those bereaved survivors, local community, who did not want the building covered because they were concerned that what had happened would be forgotten. Mm-hmm. However, on balance, they felt the tower should be covered. I think there was a recognition, particularly for the local community, that it was causing them a lot of anxiety and a lot of upset. And I've heard stories of panic attacks. And the debate we're having now is, does that mean we keep the tower and the canvassing that's going around it blank, white? Or, as has there been some suggestions, and these are initial suggestions and these are very sensitive suggestions, can we work with local artists to project drawings onto the tower? You know, drawings that may reflect the future, hope, community, family. And I've even had some discussions with school children. You know, again, very sensitive, where they could draw pictures that could be projected onto the building, where they phrase this, it'll make them smile.
Yeah.
And I think we need to talk a lot more. I need to listen a lot more. But I think the message is, if we are covering that tower, we must not forget what happened.
The teeth, the bones, the body parts are being identified for burial or to complete the process of cremation. Now we've started, we can't stop thinking about the location some say is not so far away, where the process, the procedures, God Almighty, the scale of it, the eye for detail, the expertise on which we depend to deliver truth, prosecutions, blind to authority, blind to power, justice for Grenfell. What's justice?
I'm Stuart Cundy. I'm a commander within the Metropolitan Police Service, and one of my responsibilities is to oversee the investigation and the operation related to Grenfell Tower.
You recently announced the final death toll. Does that mean that the recovery operation's over?
So the police operation to search, to find those that died and recover them, and then ultimately identify them and return them to families, started on day one. So we have now concluded that chapter of our operation. We know that there's 71 people who died as a result of the fire.
Can you tell us what's involved in the operation?
Once we recovered what is visually identifiable, we then need to very meticulously go through every single part of the tower, and that's all of the flats, all of the communal areas, the lifts, everything, to make sure we have found and recovered every possible piece of human remains that was left behind. And it is distressing, and the families are aware of this, but we haven't been finding bodies like many people would consider. There's no better way to describe it, sadly, than human remains. Mm. And to do that, our staff, working with a huge range of experts from forensic anthropologists, forensic archaeologists, odontologists, so people who are experts in teeth, have literally by hand gone through about 15 and a half tons of debris on each and every floor of the tower that was damaged by the fire to recover the smallest possible fragments. So anything that is about, you know, 5 millimetres or more, we have recovered through fingertip searching, which is why it has taken us so long. And that's the search operation within the tower. And then after that, once the, you know, the remains are recovered, it then enters a mortuary process where, again, you know, the experts have done an incredible job to then, you know, it's bring together the people that have died in the tower, individually identify them. And of course, the heartache and the uncertainty for a lot of families lasted for such a long period of time. So it was only within the last few weeks did we confirm the identities to the coroner's satisfaction of the last two, which is why in November I then announced that the final number of those that had died was 71, which includes the stillborn child.
Thank you.
In an industrial park 30 miles west of London, another part of the recovery operation is taking place. I went to meet Robert Jensen, chief executive of Kenyon International, a crisis management company with experience of major disasters from 9/11 and the Bali bombings to Hurricane Katrina and the Haiti earthquake.
We're in a really big warehouse with boxes stacked with clothing, shoes, possessions on the floor, some in bags, some rolled up. There are two ladies sitting at a desk with white overalls on and masks.
So the team in the tower would go into the flats and collect the items, put them in these plastic bins that you see, or boxes to carry down the stairs. Remember, everything's got to be where a person can carry it, maybe two if it's a little bit bigger. Gets loaded onto a truck, escorted truck back to here, unloaded, and they're going through them now to create the inventory, because that way then the family member can say, oh, this is what I want or not want.
I can see a clothes rail with what looks like washed clothing, everything from adult clothing to children's clothing.
We don't want to just say, oh, here's the clothes we've taken out of your flat and, you know, yeah, go wash them. We're trying to make them so that you can wear them and not be reminded of that really horrible day.
So this is obviously an ongoing process. Can you tell us how long you expect this to take?
I think it really depends on when people get housing. Because you just can't tell them, oh, here's your stuff. You know, put it in your hotel room. You got to wait till they're ready. Then they can contact us and we'll say, okay, when can we deliver your stuff? But think of it this way. It's 2 in the morning, 1:30, 1:40. You've woken up and maybe you grabbed a jacket and maybe you were lucky and in your jacket you kept your wallet or your keys to your car. But let's just say you weren't lucky and you just grabbed your stuff and ran out. That's the last time you went in your flat. And that flat to you represents everything that you've worked hard to build.
Memories.
Not only your memories, it's your stability. So it's being able to collect all those things, preserve them so they, you know, not have further damage, and then be able to return them in a way where a family can say, maybe I get my new house now. Maybe I can now start what I call my new normal. Some people will make that transition. Sadly, not everyone does.
So as I understand it, what you do is to try to give them as much of a normal life after the event.
We try to create as much opportunity for them. That's a journey they have to make on their own, because I'm not them.
My name is Anthony Gardner. I'm the Senior Vice President of Government and Community Affairs at the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in New York City. My oldest brother, Harvey, who was killed on 9/11, was and remains my source of inspiration. That morning on September 11th, Harvey found himself trapped on the 83rd floor of the North Tower. So from the earliest days, I found comfort in uniting with other family members first. I realized that there was a value to that and that we could help each other through this process. I think it's very important in the aftermath of these events that people don't feel isolated and alone, that they understand that there are people just like them living with this and dealing with this.
Can I call for any of the bereaved families and the survivors as well? If you'd like to make your way towards the front, and if everyone could just make some space by moving back and just coming around this way, please.
Today is the 14th of November. This is the fourth Grenfell Silent March. So basically we march every month from the Methodist Church, which is across the road from Grenfell Tower, and we march round Ladbroke Grove and then come back round to the Truth Wall, where it culminates in a minute silence. And we start at 7 o'clock.
We're small and disconnected and tired, and as powerless as we've ever been. And coming together feels almost too raw. And everywhere you look, there are people walking around in a daze, haunted by ghosts, by images, by voices they try to shut out.
Not only this time, but next month and the months to follow, we will gather together Grenfell residents, the bereaved families, and the community to show that we will not forget what happened on the 14th of June. And we will continue to support each other and seek justice.
No justice!
No peace!
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 My life has changed dramatically since the fire. All I can think about is what happened. Friends of mine that I lost, other people that came out of the fire but have been affected forever. You know, I'm not sleeping properly, I'm not eating properly. It just seems that every single day I'm living with this disaster. And I'm trying to figure out ways that I can help my community heal. And one of the ways that I've been doing that is by documenting what's been happening through a video blog that I started with some friends called Grenfell Speaks. People in my community, you know, are walking around lost, confused, traumatized, angry, stressed. But yeah, we just keep doing what we need to do in order to help each other out. So we're on our way to see a lady called Amanda Beckles, who I've never met, but who's been doing what most of us have been doing to get her feedback on how she feels and what she's been up to.
Hello?
Hi, Amanda.
Is that Faisal?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm coming down.
Okay.
It's right outside my bedroom window, so I could see it every day. But funnily enough, it was just part of my landscape. It was just there as a building.
Yeah. How do you feel about seeing that every day, you know, when you wake up?
I keep the curtains closed now. I don't open them, and I won't open them until it's demolished, because it is very difficult looking at that building sometimes, you know, and especially in my personal space as well.
I'd like to ask you how your life has changed since the event.
It's challenged my, I suppose, underlying belief that the authorities were responsible and they would take care of us. I think that was a sort of deeply seated belief that I probably didn't even really realise that I had until Grenfell, when it was really questioned. And I thought, hold on, you know, it's not what I thought. It's a pretty dire situation.
Can you tell me a bit about what happened at the last council meeting? You were talking about the focus groups that you wanted to set up. Why do you feel that this is needed?
Residents need to have their voices heard. And through these focus groups, a lot of people have got together about the various housing issues that have arisen out of this, mental health, environment, you know, such as air quality. The important thing about it is that it's not just that they're heard, but they're also seen to be heard by the rest of the community as well.
For me, what Grenfell did was we were quite separate as a community and it brought us back together. Yeah. However, what I've seen now, you know, months on, is that we're starting to fragment again.
Yes.
Have you noticed that?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I have. And it's actually quite scary. People are arguing over sometimes they're important things, sometimes not so important. We need to start understanding that we've all been through something pretty horrendous and unprecedented, and that people don't walk around with labels on their forehead saying survivor, bereaved, you know, multiple trauma, things like that. We need to treat each other with love and respect.
We had family members of the victims. We had tens of thousands of survivors and downtown residents, thousands of rescue workers. So a very sort of wide and disparate group that all had a vested interest in ultimately what happened at the site. So it was a painful process to, you know, constantly like put your loss out there and try to advocate for something that was important to you. But my personal experience was that it was worth the struggle because, you know, we have now 16 plus years later, millions of people who come to the 9/11 Memorial and the museum, continuing to use the stories of the people we lost to inspire the people that follow us.
Where are we going?
To the garden.
That's the garden. There.
And what are we going to do in the garden? Are we going to do some gardening?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm here with Opal, Luca, which you can hear, and Tayshan. These guys have started a charity called the Olive Branch Charity, right?
Yeah.
And what they've been doing has been absolutely amazing. Since the Grenfell fire happened, they've been greening up the spaces around the area.
We just went in there and kind of did something to heal ourselves, and it kind of had a knock-on effect. You know, people would offer their time, like an hour, 2 hours, a whole day. There would people be there for a week, and then you'd never see them again, and yeah. It's like... It just gave people an opportunity to use nature as a space for healing.
And we're under the Westway, which runs through the Maxilla kind of peace garden. So there's a lot of concrete around. So should we go in and you can show me what you guys have been doing for the last few months?
Yeah, for sure. So we've got plants ready to go in. If we walk through the space, overhead we're planning to have... a kind of archway of fairy lights and vines, which will kind of lead into this kind of jungle space.
I can see Luca's taking an interest in this beautiful little tree that's sort of got yellow buds coming out of it, and it's really, really symbolic of what you guys are trying to do.
Yeah. In gardening and nature, I found a way of expressing my grief and my anger, which I've kind of tried to be really productive with and creative with.
We have found it hard. I mean, Luca's first sentence was fire, Nino, and helicopter, which is not nice. You know, he feels it as well. But coming here and kind of getting our hands dirty and letting him, like, find the slugs and the snails, like, it was our happy place. And it still is. And it is for a lot of the community as well.
It's impossible to picture the street as it was. An ordinary street at the fringe of the carnival route. When the tower stood out in its smart new cladding, when persistent prophetic warnings fell with a thud on deaf ears, before tenants became survivors, trapped in distant hotel rooms, unable to move forward or to go back.
Grenfell Tower is in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. Elizabeth Campbell took over as leader of the council shortly after the fire. So, obviously, over the last 6 months, there's been a lot of mistrust between the community and the council.
Yes, understandably.
Yeah. What needs to happen for us to kind of move forward?
Well, I think the first step for the healing process is probably for people who've lived in the tower, who are survivors, who are victims, who are bereaved. Once they can get their own front door and they have their own home, I think that's a huge step on their journey to recovery. And then for people who are living round and about, perhaps the key is in sort of refurbishment of Lancaster West estate so that they feel that they've got a stake in the future, mm-hmm. and hope.
What do you think, as she is a member of the community?
I think the community is fractured.
Yes.
There's a lot of frustration, a lot of anger, which is understandable because people have had to deal with a lot of incompetence in the past. Is there a way that you can kind of reassure the community that you're doing what needs to be done, but you also understand what they're going through?
I think that's the key, isn't it? I mean, for example, I was at Al Hassania on Friday. One of the ladies, I was talking to her daughter, and I was saying, but your mother, you know, why is she in a hotel? It might take a few more months before she's ready to take the decision about where she wants to live permanently. Can you not have a flat, be a service apartment? And she just said, people don't trust you. If they're in a hotel, they figure, well, they'll have to do something about us eventually. But if we go into a flat, maybe we'll be forgotten. And we can say to we're blue in the face, no, 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 your priority will stay the same. It comes back to that lack of trust, exactly what you said in the beginning.
6 months on, where are we in terms of what happens with the tower?
There's a whole conversation about who's going to be responsible for it. And it won't be the council. And I think that's right, because it's something which we're going to have to handle with great sensitivity, given the circumstances. And I would hope that they would consider maybe having a trust or a commission so they could work with the community so that the community can decide what they think would be a fitting memorial.
It's good to meet you, mate. How you doing? You okay?
All right, yeah. So
you're... After a fire killed six people in a tower block in South London 8 years ago, the building remained standing. John McGrath was chair of the Residents Association at the time.
That is a building. So this is that's Lack and all us, yeah. We didn't want it pulled down. We thought there was nothing wrong with the building outside the 9 flats that were burnt, and there was 98 flats here. We live in the memory of Lack and all what happened, and that would be there for the rest of our lives. But these people here have got homes. And that's the most important thing, you know.
So you said a very interesting thing just now. You live in the memory of Lacknell. How did you move on from that?
You're standing in it. This is the garden, memorial garden.
So this is the memorial garden that came out of the...
We suggested this, and we all come round here, and we had a nice big meeting and a do. And what's happening now is we've got South London Gallery getting the children to do drawings and stuff, and we want to put not a massive big memorial, a small memorial either end to just remind people that there was a thing here, and it's just a nice little thing, nothing big, so that people can move on with their lives. I mean, I lived through World War II, I don't keep talking about it, yeah. You know, you get on with your life, you know, and that's what we want to see, and this is one of the best little estates in London to me, you know. I mean, I've been here 35 years.
And when did people move back into the
They started
building?
This year. The final lot moved in September. I mean, they completely gutted it. Don't get me wrong. New kitchens, new everything in there. So they're happy. Everyone I spoke to said, cool, lovely.
How did you feel when you heard about the fire at Grenfell Tower, John?
Gutted. Absolutely gutted. Lessons not learned. I would pull that down because that's a different situation than this. That's looked like the bombs hit it, you know what I mean? It's obliterated to me, and I think in that area it's more like Kensington. This is standing on a small estate, and people have moved in. So, you know, that's my opinion.
So if you had a message to the people at Grenfell, what would you say?
You'll always grieve, but get on with your life.
Flickering shadows in the mind. The dead are present even when we forget them, even in the words we fail to speak. But when concerned observers publish words of anger or distress, attempting to be the voice of those who have lost the most, we're left with little more than dust on our lips.
How long do you need the tower for to continue the investigation?
Once we've done our examination of the tower itself, which, you know, I believe will be concluded in about February or March of next year, we will then move to another phase, which is our sort of forensic testing reconstruction phase. I can't give a definitive timeline, but I hope that that might be concluded by June 2018. Now, I know that is a very long period of time. That is about a year from that terrible day itself. But this is one of the largest investigations the Met Police has ever undertaken. We need to be very meticulous in what we do because we know our investigation, and rightly so, will come under incredible scrutiny if there are any subsequent proceedings and indeed in the work we're doing with the public inquiry as well.
What happens to the towel when you've finished?
Once we've secured the best possible evidence, and that's our goal, is about securing the best possible evidence, it will then be handed back to whoever's going to take responsibility for the building.
What happens if lawyers need access to that maybe 3 years down the line or 4 years down the line? You know, if the tower were to come down, how can you reassure us 100% that we will get everything we need to pursue justice?
By the time we finish our investigation, our inquiries within the tower itself, all of the evidence will have been taken away. So we will have taken away everything that we physically can remove, which we might need for our inquiries. We would have done the full record of the tower, both from a photography, a video, a 3D laser, you know, modelling imagery of the tower itself. So what will remain at the end of it will be, in essence, the shell of the building. You know, it isn't the Grenfell Tower that everybody called home already. And once we finished our work, you know, we would have taken even more of the tower away.
Michael Lockwood.
What we'll be left with then, maybe say at the end of June, is a building that's covered with our scaffolding. So it'll be an empty shell. And then comes a decision what happens next. And I think that's important we start thinking about that, because for some of the bereaved, not knowing what's going to happen on that tower is causing them anxiety. They want clarity as best we can. For others, it's too early to start that conversation. So we've got to step very carefully, but that is the next big discussion. There is a choice for that community to make whether to have that building to come down or not. And again, a bit like the covering, we will have different views. But we must try and come to a consensus as soon as we can. And things that have started to emerge are things like Memorial Gardens and Memorial Park. And the word special, something they're proud of, something that they own. Mm-hmm. They're very concerned that nothing's built on that site. And a very early message, they want to be involved what's happened. And I was taken aback in some of the meetings where people were putting their hands up saying, I've got this skill, I'm an architect, I would like to help. And I think we need to nurture that. So what is built on there is theirs.
People who are beginning the memorialization process at Grenfell may want to consider looking at retaining some sort of tangible item, whether it's a tree or a component of the building. There are so many artifacts that speak to resilience and hope. And in the recovery operation at the World Trade Center site, rescue workers found this tree. Its roots were snapped, its limbs were charred and broken off, and it was, you know, peering out of the rubble. It showed some signs of life, and so it was taken off site, it was nurtured and brought back to life over a series of many, many years. It was planted here at the 9/11 Memorial just before it opened on the 10th anniversary, and it's really become a symbol of resilience and hope.
After the fire, a lot of people came down to the area to pay their respects. There were so many messages of condolences, of love, of frustration. And, you know, standing outside on a cold, wet December afternoon, I can see that we need to start thinking about ways of getting this part of history inside. However, there are kind of mixed feelings towards what we should do with them. Some people are saying that, you know, the children, you know, have to see pictures of their friends and their loved ones when they walk to and from school, and that really upsets them. Others don't want them touched because people come to this area specifically to pay their respects to the people that have been lost.
The missing posters that we made of our loved ones and hung all around the city became our first memorials to the victims. And so my recommendation for the Grenfell community would be to consider bringing in museum professionals, local partners, historical societies within the community to come up with some kind of collections management plan to ensure that those posters and items get cataloged and preserved by somebody before they're lost. They're an important part of the story. Like 9/11, it's not a static event that happened, you know, in one day in the past. It's an event that continues to inform and directly affect that community. And those tribute items are an important part of that ongoing story.
It's clear that nobody wants this disaster to be forgotten. But what's the best way to pay respects to those people that lost their lives on that night? This is a question that I've asked everyone that I've spoken to.
What I would like to see would be somewhere that's peaceful so that the bereaved, if they wish, could come back and reflect. It should celebrate their lives, reflect the diversity of the communities that lived in that tower and the positive contributions that those different groups made to this area and to society as a whole.
I feel like it would be really lovely to have it as green as possible and really lovely to have all community organisations who are doing something really positive on board of that, so it's not just something that, you know, the council take control of.
The best memorial is to institute change. It'd be the best memorial, and then hopefully that'll happen. Figure out what you want a memorial to mean. Figure out what everyone there wants a memorial to mean. Is it to remember? Is it to learn? Is it to call for activism? Is it to not forget those that died? It's probably going to be a combination of all the above.
The people that we've lost are never going to come back, but they can't have died in vain. I think the most important thing is for us to be able to trust the authorities. We should not stop until justice has been served.
And what does that look like?
I don't really know the answer to that.